This is the morning brief from the Economic Times.
In the last few weeks, the government had been announcing a bunch of measures to curb inflation.
Citing a threat to food security, the Modi government today prohibited the export of wheat.
Center has announced steps that will reduce fuel prices across the country. Central excise duty on fuel has been slashed, which means petrol prices will dip by 9.5 rupees per litre.
Finance Ministry on Saturday notified export duty on 11 iron and steel intermediaries, and at the same time, it lowered the import duty on 3 key raw materials for steel production.
A ban on wheat exports, excise duty cuts on petrol and diesel, customs duty cut on raw materials like steel and plastic, and a levy of 15% export duty on steel products to increase domestic supply. Not just this, the government is also working to ease cement supply and bring the prices down. But how do these measures translate to cheaper stuff for you and me? Do they at all? Or are these just reactive measures that are too little too late? In this episode, I speak to two experts to understand all this. Ratan Roy, Senior Visiting Fellow at the Center for Policy Research, who is also the Managing Director, Research and Policy at the Overseas Development Institute. And ET is Resident Editor of Delhi and the North Region, Vinay Pandey. It's Tuesday, 31st of May. I'm your host, Bhavya Dilip Kumar. And you are listening to India's War Against Inflation, Who is Winning? On The Morning Brief. Everything, and I mean everything, is getting more expensive. And if you are like me, keeping a tab on your daily bills and note your expenses down to the last decimal, you'd be traumatized too. Let's deep dive into what the government's measures are and how effective or not it is for the economy and for someone like you and me. Let's first tackle the question in everyone's minds. How far is the Russia-Ukraine war responsible for aggravating inflation in India? You'd actually be surprised by what Dr. Roy told me.
It's not purely the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The Russia-Ukraine crisis has accelerated an inflationary tendency by increasing the prices of imports from the whole world. And that's a knock-on. So basically, Russia exports a hell of a lot of natural gas, some oil, to Europe. And the demand for that has gone up. Because the demand for that has gone up, the demand for petroleum products, petrol, diesel have gone up. Those prices have gone up. Because those prices have gone up, we have imported the inflation on that count into the economy. For the rest, the inflation is structural. It comes from supply chain difficulties that have been occurring throughout the world. It comes from the high cost of transport and logistics that this country has, especially in the movement of goods. And it comes from an underlying trend of relatively high wholesale price inflation.
Before the government announced some measures, the RBI called for an emergency meeting and hiked the repo rate by 40 basis points, which was basically aimed to take away some liquidity in the market, making borrowings more expensive, and in turn, bring down consumer spending and the inflation. Remember, the RBI hadn't touched borrowing rates for a very long time because it didn't want to disturb post-COVID economic growth. In fact, rates were at a record low. But there's a catch. The inflation we see right now is not demand pull inflation, rather a cost push or supply impact linked inflation, which means people don't suddenly want to buy more than before. The things they want to buy are in short supply.
This is not demand pull inflation. This economy is not overheating because of excess demand. God forbid. This economy is overheating because of structural and supply side factors. And there is no sign that the government or anybody else is trying to address these factors. In those circumstances, when the RBI does what it has to do, if the RBI starts to increase interest rates sharply, which it will need to do given its inflation mandate, it's quite the right thing for it to do. And unfortunately, it is doing it way too late. Then the consequences could be dangerous for everybody in the sense that we could have a prolonged period of stagnation, which would be rather unfortunate and avoidable.
I asked ET's Vinay Pandey to help me understand why the RBI is trying to kill demand when the issue actually lies on the supply side.
So if you recall, everybody, when inflation started going up initially, even the US Fed, they said that we will look through it as it seems like primarily a supply side inflation, okay, and a temporary shock, and eventually things will settle down. And also at that point of time, you did not want to take any measures because the economy was reviving. You didn't want to hurt the economy, the revival.
Yeah.
And if the assumption was that this is a temporary supply side shock inflation because of the pandemic, supply issues are there, then hopefully it will resolve on its own. And if we take any measures, then we'll be only killing growth. Now, the problem is that the nature of inflation hasn't really changed, you know. It is still remains a supply side inflation. But the problem is that it is becoming entrenched now. And the fear is that it will then spill over into a generalized inflation where if my food, if my fuel, all these inflation are up, then at some stage, I'm going to also, as a worker employer, I'm going to be asking for higher wages to make up for this higher cost of living. So then that's how the wage prices spiral comes in, that higher prices will lead to demand for higher wages will lead to demand for goods, and eventually it becomes a well-entrenched inflation. So in that sense, that is why central banks have suddenly realizing that, look, this can really get out of hands. They have started to really come down heavy on rates.
You did say that this is gradual and this is what's bound to happen and it's expected. Did it kind of shock the common man? Because EMIs are going to get costlier. Like you said, there is no problem in the demand. There is this just the cost push. There is an impact on the savings. The EMIs, like I said, is going to get costlier.
So if we look at EMIs, have just started to inch up. So in that sense, it's going to take a while for you to really feel the pinch. And also if when the rate rises start, initially the banks tend to stretch the repayment period instead of hiking the EMIs. So in that sense, you may not immediately feel the pinch. Rate hikes have come in. The government has cut the fuel prices. Okay. So it's all about the basket. So obviously, if interest rate rise, EMIs will become more. But the fact that we are coming out from really rock bottom interest rates, so you have auto loans at 7.25%, you have housing loans that are even sub 7%. So obviously, as interest rates begin to rise, then you will have this issue. But eventually, then we need to still see that the basket, that is, his consumption basket, how's it being impacted? Does the inflation really hurt me?
So the government has taken measures to ease supply side constraints too. A ban on wheat exports will increase domestic supply and cool prices. It has also made steel exports costlier and imports cheaper, which means more steel will be available in India and prices will eventually ease. And then there's the direct correlation between cutting duties on fuel, which obviously helps you and me to tank up cheaper, right? But how effective are these measures really? Dr. Roy said that the measures do not address the larger inflation issue, and duty cuts and export bans don't lead to win-win situation at all. Someone is losing big. Who? The government itself and people who depend on it for a living.
Either the fiscal public finances will become weaker because you've lost tax revenue, or you're going to spend less on something. And the most obvious place you're going to spend less on is welfare. Right? So that leaves either the macroeconomy or the person dependent on welfare support with hard choices. This is not a positive sum game. You lower taxes on petrol and excise, somebody loses and somebody gains. Now, I know the middle class gains, but who loses? Either the government, because they're forced to borrow more than they otherwise would to maintain welfare support, or those who get welfare, who would get less than they would have got, had these excise duties and taxes not been cut. So if you go through the economy like this, sector after sector, you will find that the attempt to curb inflation essentially through cutting taxes, the impact of that will depend on who bears the fiscal cost. If it's going to be borrowing, it means you're charging future generations. If it's going to be expenditure cuts to compensate for the loss in excise, it means you're going to be hurting those on whom you'd otherwise spent, right?
Dr. Roy tells me that the measures are misplaced and the government is perhaps missing the forest for the trees.
So why do you want to have low food prices? Because the poor will suffer. In which case, why not let food prices be market-based and then use your wonderful direct benefit transfer mechanisms to target the people who need food more cheaply? Give them the money to go and buy food in the market at higher prices. And then you will get higher producer prices, but they will be affordable to the groups you're most worried about. Or are you trying to subsidize the vocal part of the economy, which is the middle class? In which case, you'd follow a different set of policies. Or are you being genuinely honest and trying to get this economy up to becoming a proper upper middle income economy? In which case, you would have to work out which producer prices need to be high and which are desirably high because the economy is growing and therefore demand is growing and therefore input prices grow. And which producer prices are high because of bottlenecks, supply chain factors, rent seeking, theft, corruption, etc.
So basically, the issue lies with the approach of going for problem-specific solutions.
So you have gone for problem-specific solutions. So if you felt fuel inflation was a big issue, so you have sacrificed tax revenues and you have given a cut to the in the fuel side so that the fuel inflation moderates. Same way, if you felt the steel prices are going up, so you have imposed steel bans. Same way with wheat, and same way if you could tomorrow have cotton, you could have others. See, the point is that you've gone for a patchwork solution of wherever you're seeing a problem, you're trying to fix the leak, fix the supply side issue. I won't say leaks here. Problem with this approach is that it lights, if one thing happens, it lights up somewhere else. If we find the fuel inflation is high, we will cut taxes. If we find inflation more in steel, we are imposing export duties. So that is what has been approached. Can it work if the problem is short term? If tomorrow Russia and Ukraine sit down and decide it's over, then maybe it can work and suddenly you don't have an issue. But what if this conflict lingers and you have crude at 120 plus for a long period of time? Then obviously there is an issue. So it's a wait and watch fix, and then RBI will also probably raise its rate in next policy and then pause for a while to see how it's impacting the economy and how it's impacting the inflation.
Also, like I said, it's not a win-win. One industry's gain from these rate cuts is another's loss, Vinay explains.
See, again, we need to see that if one industry is getting hurt, let's say steel, the cheaper the steel is input for somebody else. So gets the steel at cheaper rate. So net-net, who's the gainer? If the infrastructure gets cheaper steel, while the steel industry, which has had a good run for a while, has a bit of a loss of margin, so does it matter, right? Now, I'm not making a value judgment here that this is right or wrong. What I'm saying is that impact needs to be, we need to assess the impact holistically. That cheaper cement and steel is somebody's input. While it is the industry's bread and butter, those who are producing it, they might feel the thing that, look, I've been denied my time in the sun because government did this, but there is his production is somebody's input. So how it impacts the economy is as a whole is something difficult to quantify.
So are we saying that these measures have no impact at all on the economy?
No, of course they will have an impact. They will definitely moderate inflation, but you will not see that in terms of a fall in the inflation headline numbers. You have to remember that they will moderate in the sense of the counterfactual, that if you had not taken these measures, then inflation would have been even higher than it is at the current.
Now the question is, why is the government chasing the problem? Is there an inherent inability to take proactive measures?
The logical textbook solution would be for the government to also start cutting its fiscal deficit. And you also have the high current account deficit, you know, which is both pointing to that there is more spending that is happening than required. So ideal solution would have been to start pulling in government spending at the macro level. So you don't contribute to the demand pressure and contribute to the inflation. Now, that again is a challenge. How do you cut that spending? That there is a lot of it is welfare spending. There's food subsidy, fertilizer subsidy. Can you really cut it? In fact, government is going to have to spend more on it. The other thing is the other discretionary expenditure is the CAPEX plan. Do you cut your capital spending? If you cut your capital spending, you're going to undermine your growth. The whole idea of capital spending was that you revive the economy. If the government was really worried about inflation, then you would start looking to cut the fiscal deficit down.
Dr. Roy said that the problem also lies in the fact that the government doesn't plan for the future.
If you ask anybody in the government of India to give you an analytical estimate of what India's growth rate will be in 2025, analytical, not just target. Have you ever seen a document like that? I have not. If you look at the RBI, its pronouncements are not necessarily, it's a central bank in the short term, but neither you or I are ever given the benefit of an explanation of where these numbers come from. In short, what I'm saying is that we have given up the business, the important business, of strategizing in the medium term. In those circumstances, we are left with reactive announcements, which are profoundly sometimes misplaced. And that is why they are in a large measure in a pickle. It's not just a matter of having stagflation. The pickle is that we haven't had a conversation about why this stagflation is happening and what we do to get about it.
Okay, now inflation is a massive global problem. What are other countries doing about it? In the US, inflation levels reached a 40-year high, which led to the Fed implementing a rate hike that's the highest in two decades. That led to inflation levels cooling off slightly in May. UK's inflation levels, too, have reached a four-decade high. Its central bank raised borrowing rates to the highest level since 2009, even as it issued warnings of an economic slowdown. In South Korea, inflation has reached a 13-year high, prompting a similar rate increase. Russia, of course, is the worst hit as it faces the triple whammy of a shrinking economy, record inflation levels, and unprecedented sanctions from the West. And India's neighbors, Sri Lanka and Pakistan, are in deep economic crisis due to surging inflation. So Dr. Roy explained this situation to me with the UK example.
In the UK, as I'm discovering to my cost, tax rates today are the highest level ever since the 1940s. But the median population is being subsidized by higher taxes to make sure they don't suffer. So you're having the attempt is to have a fairly progressive distributive policy so that people's daily lives and consumption of necessities is not affected by inflation. But those who are richer pay for that. So it is neutral in that sense. And therefore hope that this will create a moderation in inflation that will allow these countries to benefit from a fiscal space caused by a return to consistent GDP growth. Already, the Fiscal Responsibility Office of the Bank of the British government has calculated that the debt GDP ratio of the UK is going to start falling from about 2025, 26. When that happens, then Britain gets a little more fiscal space to invest in growth, through either public investment or through demand pumping up.
So globally and in India, this is where things stand as of now. What about the near future? RBI's much-awaited monetary policy will be announced in June. We have to wait and watch which way rates will jump. And will there be more measures from the government?
There is space for government to intervene. So on those things that you are producing, rice, wheat, sugar cane, the solution is to stop the exports, right? So that your domestic supply is adequate. So let's say cotton prices have flared up. There is a case that the government might impose ban there, or for that matter, rice, because it moves from one. If let's say there's shortage of wheat and prices go up, then obviously some people will start to buy rice, and then the price of rice will start to go up. So it moves from one to another. So at some stage, government might also think of imposing a limit on rice. Things that you don't produce and you import, obviously the only solution you can have is to reduce import duties. So these are the broadly, I mean, you can put them in two baskets. Things we produce, there may have a restriction on export. Things we don't produce, we import, there you will probably have a low duty imports on the prices. Yeah. That's the broad two basket I see.
So the government has some tough choices between growth and inflation, between the common man that votes for it and the industries that give it growth numbers to boast, between short-term measures that make for good headlines and long-term ones that lead to a healthier economy. As long as the government's measures are reactive, there is no answer to these questions. I'll let Dr. Roy have the last words on this.
So our dilemma is a domestic one. The solutions are not easy. The solutions are essentially structural and will involve one of two things. To get back to stable, sustainable growth in 3 or 4 years' time, we will either have to accept the price of slightly higher inflation for the next 3 years or slightly lower growth than we would like for the next 3 or 4. It is important that we acknowledge this dilemma and we work with all stakeholders to ride over this pain that stagflation causes as efficiently, effectively, honestly, and transparently as possible. Bombastically claiming high growth or immediate quick wins in lowering inflation, as has become a habit nowadays in policy circles, is not going to do the job. We have to grow up a little bit. There's no short-term action you can do. You can protect vulnerable groups from cost-push inflation. But as I was saying, in the long term, you have to make up your mind. Do you mute cost-push inflation by essentially accepting a lower level of economic growth for the next 3 or 4 years? Or do you tolerate a higher level of inflation while you sort out the supply side and maintain a higher level of economic growth for the next 3 or 4 years? That's the trade-off that the government has to make going forward.
That's all from us today. Thank you so much, Dr. Roy and Vinay. Thank you for listening. You had been listening to India's War Against Inflation, Who's Winning? On The Morning Brief. I'm your host, Bhavya Dilip Kumar, signing off. Producers of this episode, Anirban Chaudhary from The Economic Times and Soundarya Jayachandran from Awaaz. Sound editors, Swati Joshi from Awaaz and Indranil Bhattacharji from Economic Times. Executive producer, Arijit Barman. If you like this episode, please make sure to share it on your social media. The Morning Brief airs every Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. Have a great day. All clips used in this episode belong to their respective owners. Credits mentioned in the description.